Coming up on this week's book show, the new book, The Deportation Machine, traces the long and troubling history of the U.S. government's systematic efforts to expel immigrants over the past 140 years. Professor of History and Latin American and Latino Studies at the University of Illinois, Adam Goodman, examines how federal, state, and local officials have targeted various groups for expulsion. Adam Goodman on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Constant headlines about deportations, detention camps, and border walls drive urgent debates about immigration and what it means to be an American in the 21st century. The new book, The Deportation Machine, traces the long and troubling history of the U.S. government's systematic efforts to terrorize and expel immigrants over the past 140 years. Author Adam Goodman explains how federal, state, and local officials have targeted various groups for expulsion from Chinese and Europeans at the turn of the 20th century to Central Americans and Muslims today. He reveals how authorities have singled out Mexicans, 9 out of 10 of all deportees, and removed most of them, not by orders of immigration judges, but through coercive administrative procedures and calculated fear campaigns. Adam Goodman is Assistant Professor of History and Latin American and Latino Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the book show this week. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe.
What brought you to this subject initially?
Well, I actually grew up in upstate New York in the Capital Region listening to WAMC, but there are a few different factors that I think influenced the genesis of this project. And one was living in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas, right on the U.S.-Mexico border. I taught high school there briefly, and while there, I saw the impact that migration policies had on the lives of real people, my students and their families, as well as the region as a whole. Second thing that really factored into the genesis of this project was the political context in which it came about. During the early years of the Obama administration and later during the Trump administration, there was increased attention to immigration policy, the punitive impact it had on people living in the country, and also the activism organizing that was going around in response. But perhaps the most important thing that led me to the project was a startling discovery, and that was the United States has deported 57 million people since the 1880s, more than any other country in the world. And as you noted briefly, 85% of those expulsions have occurred without due process. We know very little about them, in fact. And as I dug a little bit deeper, I realized that federal officials have deported more people than they've allowed to remain on a permanent basis during the last century, which raises the question that begins the book, and that is, what kind of nation is the United States?
57 million people since 1882, and this happens as this country is celebrated for being a nation of immigrants, and the idea that we have welcomed foreigners throughout our history.
That's right. There's a tension throughout U.S. history between the United States as a nation of immigrants, one that's welcomed foreigners, and one that has been very selective in who it admits, who it accepts, and who it allows to stay in the country. And that tension runs through U.S. history. And I think the myth that is known far and wide and has been really propagated in the last half century is more toward the former, right, toward the welcoming. And I think that's why, in part, the current administration stands in stark contrast to people's perceived understanding of the nation's history. And what my book, in fact, and research shows is that, you know, the United States has long been a nation that has deported immigrants. It has long been a nation that has targeted specific groups for exclusion and for expulsion. And I think that, in turn, you know, raises really important questions about not only who the United or who we are as a country, but also, you know, who is American, who is thought or imagined to be in the fold, and who is thought to be an outsider.
When and how did you come to this idea of looking at this as a machine, as a deportation machine?
Yeah, that was not something that I was thinking of when the project first came about 10 years ago. But over time, I started to see that the interconnected mechanisms of the machine, and I lay out three in detail. You know, the first are formal deportations, which were more familiar with, traditionally have happened by order of an immigration judge or a court. You know, but these represent just a small sliver of the total number of expulsions. And I saw that the formal deportations allowed officials to exert coercive pressure on people to leave the country under the euphemistically termed voluntary departures. Now, there's nothing voluntary about them. This is an administrative expulsion that I liken to the role that plea bargains play in the criminal justice system. So if a prosecutor, you know, threatens someone with 35 years in prison, perhaps they can get them to plead to, you know, a lesser sentence of 5 years. You know, voluntary departures function in a similar way. They help the deportation machine run. In addition to the third mechanism, which are self-deportation campaigns built on fear, immigration raids, the strategic use of the media, the ever-present threat of violence and restrictive immigration laws. And so it's these three mechanisms, formal deportations, voluntary departures, and self-deportation campaigns that function together, that authorities have mechanized and weaponized to increase their power, all right, to ensure that there is a exploitable migrant labor force, as well as to draw some of those lines I was mentioning before and foment, I think, xenophobia in strategic ways.
You do write in the book that the machine has not always functioned smoothly or at peak capacity, but when it has run on all cylinders, undocumented immigrants and even some authorized immigrants and U.S. citizens have found themselves under an all-out physical and psychological assault. Is that what we're seeing right now?
Without a doubt. The Trump administration has made very clear, right, that it is anti-immigrant, whether that is documented or undocumented. It would like to curtail and limit all types of migration. And, you know, I think that it's safe to say that perhaps some of the actions aren't unprecedented, but the fear campaigns in particular have been ratcheted up to levels we have not seen in recent decades.
Going back to the 1800s, when you see this first starting to take hold, why does fear work? What is it about us that allows the fear campaign to be successful?
I think the fear is doing two things. One is to provoke fear amongst the native population or those who are already in the country. That is in terms of the fear that what immigrants or foreigners represent, a threat to the culture, a threat to the economy, and that can foment in a number of different ways. But the second way in which fear has been deployed, starting in the late 1800s, is really as a strategic way to push people out of the country using psychology rather than force. It's kind of seen as a soft power deportation mechanism. I don't think there's anything soft about it. I think it's very punitive, very violent in many ways, even if there isn't always physical violence involved. You know, in the late 1880s, I traced the roots of self-deportation as a strategy to a small town in the Sierra Nevada, Truckee, California, right outside of Lake Tahoe. And there's a gentleman there named Charles McGlashan. And Charles McGlashan, you know, still to this day remembered as one of, kind of the founders of the town and a very prominent individual, Renaissance man of sorts. But what most remembrances leave out is that he was an ardent nativist and an anti-Chinese activist. He used the newspaper, of which he was the editor, to foment fear about the threat the Chinese posed, and organized economic boycotts, and organized different campaigns to try to get the Chinese to leave, quote unquote, on their own. Although what I show is that the ever-present threat of apocalyptic violence was always right under the surface. So if the threat is real and people understand what the potential consequences are, whether these are punitive laws, whether these are immigration raids or actual physical violence and assaults and killings, if people know that that threat is real, then they might be more likely in turn to leave, right, through quote unquote self-deportation. Now, you know, I think that is a tried and true strategy we've seen, and people's lives have been made so miserable that some have in fact left. But I also want to point out that under this administration, as in the past, most people have not left. You know, most people have remained. They fought for the right to remain, and they fought to make their lives better.
Adam Goodman is our guest. The name of the new book is The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. The book is published by Princeton University Press. That idea of expulsion, and you use it a lot in the book, the idea of it really comes down to we don't want you, right?
You could say that. I might just modify slightly and say we want you, but not on a permanent basis. We want you for your labor, but we don't necessarily want you as a permanent member of our society. I think that national elites, as well as some ordinary Americans, have expressed those sentiments and put them into action. But I think they've also been contested throughout history as well. And different groups have been targeted, from the Chinese in the late 19th century to Southern Eastern Europeans at the turn of the 20th century, to Mexicans for most of the last 100 plus years, and more recently, certainly Central Americans, Muslims, Arabs, South Asians. But one of the real findings of the book is that Mexicans represent close to 9 out of 10 deportations throughout U.S. history. The history of deportation from the United States has been a history of targeting Mexicans while at the same time recruiting them for their labor and not including them, you know, as full members of society.
You write in a chapter of the book called The Human Costs of the Business of Deportation that immigration historians know little about how authorities have forcibly removed people, and even less about the U.S. government contracting private companies to effect expulsions. How does that happen? How does that happen under the radar?
I'm glad you brought that up. We do know very little about the actual physical process. You know, we hear about immigration raids. We hear about policies and deportations in the headlines. But what does it actually look like to physically apprehend an individual or a family, to take them to custody, to process them for removal, and to physically move them or transport them out of the country? And in the chapter you reference, you know, I trace the use of buses and trains, boats and planes that authorities have used for these purposes, oftentimes relying on private third parties. Immigration policy sometimes is thought of as a question of domestic politics. Others have kind of argued that it's a question of foreign relations and negotiations between nation states. But I think what the business of deportation shows, and what I'm able to reveal in the book, is that oftentimes perverse economic incentives played an important role in shaping not only the making, but also the implementation of immigration policy. And transportation has also been a key way that authorities have tried to discourage people from returning to the country by punishing them. So the method used to transport people out of the country has been punitive in nature, right? And I trace the history of the boat lifts in the mid-1950s. There were around 50,000 Mexicans transported across the Gulf of Mexico on privately owned Mexican transportation vessels that took bananas north from Mexico to the United States and returned in those same boats in the same holds with deportees to Veracruz. And this operation was meant to prevent people from returning. It was meant to punish. And there's a quote that'll always stick in my mind that I found in the National Archives from the Commissioner of the Immigration Service at that time, Joseph M. Swing, who was a former lieutenant general in the Army that President Eisenhower had named commissioner. And what he said was that the Mexicans hate the boat lift like the devil hates holy water. Right? I mean, if there was ever a question about kind of the nature of this deportation operation and what it was meant to do, whether or not it was punitive, you know, that quote kind of laid that question to rest, that it was certainly meant to punish, and that it's the state policies over time that have created a market in deportable people. And they've turned deportation into a lucrative business. And it's the migrants, unfortunately, that, you know, have usually paid the physical, psychological, and material costs.
So talk about that a little bit, because you write about how the changing of immigration laws and enforcement practices has resulted in this growing number of people who are then considered undocumented. So if you change the definition, you have more people who are considered undocumented, then that creates a market in deportable people. Then how is that made into a business in the sense of where does the money come from?
So some of the money is coming from, you know, certainly federal taxpayer dollars that are funding the government and its various public functions. But there are private companies that see opportunity when they understand the United States is deporting an increasing number of people because the laws have now made a larger group expellable. They start soliciting contracts with the federal government. So, you know, the archive reveals that there were private individuals, Mexican pilots who owned planes that offered their services to the U.S. federal government to deport people from California and Arizona on a weekly basis into the Mexican interior. There's a transportation company in the mid-1950s from the Caribbean that likewise writes and offers its services to the U.S. federal government. And they saw a business opportunity here. And implicit in this is that deportees, these human beings, right, oftentimes, you know, U.S. citizens or permanent residents or their family members were included in these deportation operations. And they're being treated not as humans, but as cargo. And I think the private transportation companies saw them as such, without a doubt. And U.S. officials, you know, if they didn't see them in that way, they were certainly okay with them being treated in that way.
What part of that is illegal slash legal in the sense of how all parties involved in what you just described are able to get away with that? Especially given the horrid conditions on how the deportees are being transported.
Oftentimes, these actions were legal based on the law, and there are few protections for migrants. Or if they weren't legal, authorities found ways around them. So, for example, one of the things that contracting private Mexican shipping companies in the mid-1950s allowed authorities to do was to meet lesser safety standards as required by the Mexican vessels and the Mexican government, as opposed to the U.S. standards. And they, you know, consciously tried to skirt those policies, as I was able to trace in the archive. But I think the larger question here is not necessarily whether it's legal or illegal, but also what types of policies should the United States have, right, in regards to immigration? And for a large part of our history, it's very clear that the well-being of migrants, and I think that we really need to break down this false divide or false binary between us and them. And so many migrants and people who have been put in immigration proceedings and deportation proceedings, they themselves have lived in this country for years or decades. They're very much a part of this nation, an essential part. They are members, just like so many others. And, you know, they should be treated as such and provided the same, you know, legal protections and humanitarian protections as we would hope anyone else would have.
When you look at what has occurred in counter to this business and what has occurred during this administration, what gives you hope in the future? Because there are a lot of really good people who are working very, very hard to try to turn this around.
Without a doubt. And there's a through line here as well that's important to recognize. And that's as immigration policies, in a sense, have continuously been punitive in nature and targeting certain people under atrocious conditions, people have also fought back consistently and learned from past struggles, built on past struggles. And this organizing has oftentimes been migrant-led, though solidarity has been key as well with activists and labor organizers, lawyers, ordinary citizens who have contributed to these struggles and trying to understand how the deportation machine works at any particular point in time to identify weak spots in the machine and then in turn apply pressure to them. And I think we're certainly seeing that today, that people are organizing actively, they're recalibrating, trying to understand perhaps the current administration's strategies and how to best combat it. And I think in some cases it takes a little while to get there, but through mass solidarity, as we've seen in recent weeks, not necessarily with immigration, but with the Black Lives Matter movement and other activism against police violence and state-sanctioned violence, that the possibilities, I think we shouldn't limit ourselves to the current system, which we might think may never change, but we should, in fact, imagine the policies and the type of world that we would like to have and push to get to that point.
There is also, I think we should point out, really bipartisan awfulness here, right? I mean, there's not
that's right.
One particular party that's wearing the black hats in this situation.
That was another realization I made throughout the process, is that in some sense, the deportation machine metaphor works because the machine has chugged along and has continued operating regardless of who's been in power, right? Democrats, Republicans alike. Deportation and punitive immigration policies have a bipartisan history. Neither party has really taken the lead here, differentiated themselves. Though I think that today we might see that changing. There's an opportunity today, perhaps, for Democrats, although I myself am not entirely optimistic, but I think it's worth holding out hope that they might stake out some ground, perhaps create some division. And, I guess time will tell. We don't know what's going to happen. As one of the lawyers involved in, really heroic, I think, organizing effort in the 1970s that I document in the book says, in an op-ed at the time, he says, history has a way of surprising the complacent. And I think that's certainly true here. So we'll see if deportation and punitive immigration enforcement policies continue to be bipartisan, or whether perhaps one party tries to stake out some ground in a different direction.
Also, we are certainly not the only country doing this. And I'm interested in how you think we stack up against the rest of the world and how that plays into this. Obviously, situations are so bad that people want to come here, but they want to go other places too, and they're not wanted there either.
That's entirely true. The United States is one of many nations of migrants, a nation that has received tens of millions of people throughout its history, and it's also a nation that's expelled tens of millions of people. And I think those two things go hand in hand. And on the one hand, the United States couldn't be a deportation nation, as some scholars have put it, if it weren't also a nation of immigrants. And I think a lot of that has to do with its historic relationship with Mexico, its need and demand for Mexican labor, and the geographic proximity of the two countries. So in some ways, I think that we could make the argument that the United States has been both more welcoming of migrants than other countries, and it has also been more discriminatory and expelling and rejecting migrants.
When you talk about the discrimination, I'm interested, because you write about this, the toll that it takes on the individuals who are deported, who are forced out.
This goes hand in hand, I think, with the last question, in that, you know, when we think of the United States as a nation of immigrants, a nation that's welcomed immigrants, I think we also oftentimes, and perhaps problematically, think of what the typical immigrant experience is. And I would say that we shouldn't necessarily think in those terms, but certainly, you know, what we see, and I think what my book shows, is that if we want to think of what the typical immigrant experience is, we really need to also wrestle with not just the success stories, the so-called, you know, stories of the American dream, which are not always backed up by the facts, but also the reality that for so many people in this country, enduring state-sanctioned violence and trauma has been a central part of their lives, both past and present. And I think that's something that we should all wrestle with. I think confronting that, right, isn't sufficient, but it is at least a first step toward pushing for humanitarian change and perhaps living up to the best ideals that this country has set out for itself.
And did we ever practice those ideals perfectly?
No.
So we
in a word.
So we have nothing to return to. We're building what we want it, hopefully, to be.
I think that's right. I think the United States, you know, has been in a constant state of becoming, perhaps, you know, what it has set out to be, or perhaps said to be on paper. And we have not met those ideals, you know, in the past. And I think that we may in the future, but it's not going to happen by chance or with people just sitting back and crossing their fingers. It's going to happen through sustained pressure. It's going to happen through solidarity and mass organizing, right? It's not something that's just going to fall into our laps, but it's going to be won through struggle.
Will a change in administration have an immediate effect? If there is a change in leadership in November, will some of the damage that has been done be able to be rectified fairly quickly?
Some of it will be, without a doubt. And I think that we have certainly seen that if on the one hand, the deportation machine is autonomous and chugs along regardless of who's in power, the current administration has made clear that it matters a great deal, right? Who's in the White House, right? This administration has done extraordinary harm to immigrants and immigrant communities, in part through its broad executive authority. It would take broad legislative reform, I think, to enact real change. And that depends on many different factors, certainly looking toward November and beyond. So it's difficult to say, but there are some ways in which, without a doubt, who's in the White House matters a great deal. And some of the recent policy changes would be reversed quickly. Others would take a considerable amount of time looking forward in the future, though impossible to say what will happen.
Adam Goodman's new book is The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. It is published by Princeton University Press. Adam, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program, and best of luck with the book.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Again, the name of the book is The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants, published by Princeton University Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.